It takes a lot of moxie to make oxygen on Mars, as you'll hear this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. NASA's Perseverance rover is closing in on the red planet. Inside the robotic explorer is an experiment that will move us farther down the road toward putting men and women on Mars. I think you'll enjoy my conversation with MOXIE Principal Investigator Mike Hecht. Want to win a Planetary Society baseball cap? You'll get another opportunity when Bruce Betts visits with another What's Up report. The exploration of our solar system marches on. You can track it in our weekly newsletter, The Downlink. A couple of the stories have progressed even since the December 11 edition appeared. For example, Japan's space agency has just announced that the sample return capsule from the Hayabusa 2 probe does indeed contain material from asteroid Ryugu. The spacecraft snapped a beautiful shot of Earth as it sped by our planet. We've got a link waiting for you at planetary.org/downlink. And as I record this, China's sample return spacecraft is nearing Earth. Chang'e 5 is believed to be carrying about 2 kilograms of lunar material. NASA has selected 18 lucky astronauts for what it calls the Artemis team. Some number of them may be the next humans to walk on the moon. We'll talk with one of them, veteran Stephanie Wilson, next week. MOXIE is the Mars Oxygen In Situ Resource Utilization Experiment. If all goes well, it will soon demonstrate that one of the most important consumables for a human trip to Mars and back can be made right there, in situ. Michael Hecht serves as principal investigator for MOXIE. He spent 30 years at JPL before moving across the United States to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Mike is also Associate Director of MIT's Haystack Observatory and Deputy Project Director for the Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration. Yes, a Mars pioneer also helps to lead that worldwide collaboration of radio telescopes that revealed a black hole for the first time in 2019. That part of our great conversation can be heard online at planetary.org/radio. But the main topic was making oxygen on Mars, something Mike hopes to attempt not long after Perseverance lands in February of 2021. Mike Hecht, thank you very much for joining us on Planetary Radio as we speak not too many weeks ahead of MOXIE and the rest of Perseverance, getting through those 7 minutes of terror and down to the Martian surface. Is the excitement building?
Oh, it absolutely is. And one thing that reminds me every evening, and I encourage the audience here to follow up on, you walk out the door in the evening as the sun goes down and you see Mars in the eastern sky glowing bright and red, outshining, almost even outshining Jupiter in the sky. And that's how you always know there's a mission on its way to Mars. That's how the orbital mechanics work out. You launch before opposition when Mars is at that peak of brightness in the evening sky, and you land after opposition. So every night when I go up and look in the sky, I know we're getting closer.
It has been gorgeous lately, hasn't it? I mean, I had the telescope out a couple of nights ago, and we were looking at Mars and some of its neighbors farther out. But it is spectacular to think that we are about to go there again, and that we'll be doing science and preparation for humans on Mars that has never been done before. You know, everybody talks about how important in situ resource utilization will be for human exploration, but you and the MOXIE team seem to be among the first to actually hope to demonstrate it.
That's absolutely the case. Yes, certainly what we've done is a source of great satisfaction. But I always go back to the fact that NASA created this opportunity is the best proof that they're serious about this enterprise. You know, when I first got involved in preparing for human exploration to Mars back in the 90s, Dan Golden was saying, we'll have astronauts on Mars as early as 2011, right? 15 years away, he was saying, and we're still talking about 15 years away. And why do I think this time is different? Well, that's one of the reasons. The fact that NASA was willing to invest of order, $50 million in actually proving ISRU on Mars, that's a real commitment.
That is such a good point. I mean, I know that you beat out a lot of other worthy projects. This space that MOXIE's taken up could have been another mass spectrometer or something like that. So I guess it is pretty significant that NASA chose this way to demonstrate that we can make what humans are going to need on Mars when we get there.
Absolutely. It's the next great adventure after the other one that Perseverance is kicking off, which is sample return. And I found Perseverance such a wonderful, complex mission in that it's dealing with science today. It's investing in the future with preparing for sample return, let's say tomorrow. And it's also preparing for the best science, in my opinion, which is when we have human scientists on the ground. Let's call it the day after tomorrow.
I love that. What inspired that great acronym, which I spelled out when I was introducing you?
The great acronym MOXIE?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, MOXIE.
Because, of course, it has an embedded acronym in it, and even that is a story. MOXIE, of course, has the general connotation of audacity. So there's the rather literal interpretation of the fact that we were a long shot group when we proposed. And the fact that we proposed at all, and inspired by my JPL colleagues, was audacious, was evidence of MOXIE. Of course, the fact that we were selected, even more so. But it also had a real local resonance for me and for my institution. I'm working at Haystack Observatory up in Western Massachusetts, down the road from Lowell, Massachusetts. Growing up in this area, MOXIE was a soft drink everybody knew. And
right.
In fact, it goes back to the late 1800s where it was the soft drink. The fact that we have this word MOXIE that means audacity comes from the advertisements for the soft drink in those days. It was invented in Lowell, Massachusetts, just down the street from us. It is even now the state drink of the great state of Maine, just to our north. And embedded in the acronym is another acronym, ISRU, In Situ Resource Utilization, which frankly, Matt, means living off the land. But as I like to say, they couldn't use the acronym LOL. It's already been taken. So,
right. So I'm doing
and
now.
And embedding an acronym is not normally something I like to do. But the first attempt to do this came on a mission that never was, the 2001 Surveyor lander. It was in its final steps of development when we lost the Polar lander. In 2000, late 1999, it was put on hold and never really flown, although it did have a sort of a resurrection with Phoenix, the Phoenix mission. But on the 2001 lander was an attempt to do a much smaller, more modest version of what MOXIE became. And that was called MIP, which was the Mars ISPP precursor. ISPP was what they used to call ISRU. It was In Situ Propellant Production. So that had an embedded acronym in it. And I thought, that's the one thing on Mars 2000, on the 2001 lander that never found another ride to Mars. And so it's a little bit of a very subtle homage to people on the inside to say, we're going to embed that same acronym in the middle of MOXIE as a little bit of an homage to the folks who developed the MIP project. It's a long story.
Yeah, but MOXIE is a little bit of a phoenix in itself, it sounds like.
Indeed it is. And, I've always been of the impression that if you propose and are selected to fly an experiment to Mars or elsewhere, NASA will eventually find a way to do it. And I don't know if it's a conscious policy or just the way it works out, but it seems that all the projects I've been involved in over the years that for one reason or another, like the 2001 mission, haven't made it, eventually find another way.
Hmm. All right, well, let's talk about what it does. I mean, I think I've heard you say and others say, and you can see pictures of it. We'll put up the link to the MOXIE website on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio with lots of other resources. It is only about the size of a car battery. How much O2 are you going to get out of this little box?
That is the key question, Matt. And we're limited not by what we could build. We could build a full-size MOXIE unit today, probably as easy or easier than the effort to build this small one. But we have two serious constraints. One constraint is that we're on a rover that's only so big, and we share it with, you know, seven other instruments. The other constraint that's even more significant is this rover, this big rover, the size of a Mini Cooper, right, runs off of 100 watts, 110 watts. You know, back in the day when we had incandescent light bulbs, a light bulb on your desk lamp would have been brighter than, you know, more power than that. It's a very, very puny power system. To do what we want to do on Mars to support human exploration will take 25, 30 kilowatts. So just to run on this small power supply, power system, we had to scale way, way back. Nonetheless, we can demonstrate all the principles, all the technology, all the hardware on a small scale. And so MOXIE will produce about 10 grams an hour of oxygen. Now, if you and I were sitting having this conversation on Mars, or in fact, sitting on having this conversation today, we're probably consuming about 20 grams an hour, about twice what MOXIE will produce. It's about the amount that if I look out my window at the trees, that a modest-sized tree in my yard will also produce about 10 grams an hour of oxygen from the CO2 in our atmosphere.
I thought that humans needed a lot more O2 per hour, and so a couple of these little boxes would be able to keep me alive on Mars, apparently, if it performs as well as you hope it will.
Well, absolutely. Keeping humans alive is easy. And that's really not the main purpose of the MOXIE technology. The common link, though, to the main purpose is that we, as human beings, use fuel. Okay, we use fuel. We call it food. But if we weren't appreciating it aesthetically, we'd call it fuel. And to burn fuel requires oxygen or something like oxygen, whether you're a human being, whether you're a fireplace, whether you're an automobile, or in this case, whether you're a rocket ship. And the more fuel that something uses, the bigger it is, the more oxygen it needs. The thing that we do not appreciate on Earth is that this oxygen that we are burning, that our car is burning when we drive, weighs much, much more than the fuel. Fuel is light. It's based on hydrogen. It's very light stuff. And so if we had to carry an oxygen tank in our cars, because we couldn't get oxygen for free in the air around us, it would weigh maybe four times what the gasoline weighs. So if we're thinking what we need to bring to Mars and what it weighs, the single heaviest thing we would need to bring is a tank of oxygen. Not for the astronauts, that would be a little tank, but for this rocket that is going to take our crew from the surface of Mars back up into space, lift it off the ground, climb out of the gravity well of Mars, that uses a tremendous amount of fuel. And of course, it needs to breathe a tremendous amount of oxygen. So really, the customer for MOXIE is primarily that ascent vehicle, that Mars ascent vehicle, that rocket that will return our crew to Mars orbit as the first leg on their return journey, and which I think so many of us read about and saw in the movies in Andy Weir's The Martian.
I think a lot of what you have talked about over the last few minutes demonstrates something else I've heard you say, but I wonder if you could maybe give us another example of what you're talking about. When you say that we need to think like Martians,
yes, that's the hardest thing in the world to do, is to think like a Martian. This is what fascinates me about the study of Mars, the planetary science part of it, because it makes you aware of just how much we take for granted, just how much is wired in about the way we interact with the universe. And when you go to a place that's even subtly different, where the ground rules change, where the where you have blue clouds in a pink sky, you realize just how much of a foundation your world experience has imposed on what we see as objective science. It causes you to rethink so many things. I love that experience. A simple example I love to give has to do with temperature. Of course, Everyone talks about temperature. It's too cold in this room. It's too warm in this room. I feel a draft. And that is a deeply ingrained concept that is relevant only in places like Earth that have an atmosphere that's so thick. You know, to a Martian, we'd look like fish swimming in an ocean. We are walking around in such a thick atmosphere. And it is so thick that, in fact, when the atmosphere is cold, we get cold. And when the atmosphere is warm, we get warm. And that is a unique characteristic of this kind of thick atmosphere. And even today, I constantly hear engineering saying, oh, we shouldn't send humans to the poles because it's too cold, or go to this other place where it's too warm. Then I have to stop them and say, now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I mean, think about the atmosphere you're talking about. And talk to an astronaut like my colleague Jeff Hoffman, who's the the deputy PI from OXY and has flown in the shuttle 5 times. You get into space, you're hot. Now, is space hot? Is space cold? Well, neither. And the reason it's neither is because we use temperature as a proxy for heat, because on Earth, in this thick soup, you can use temperature as a proxy for heat. If you're in space, you're hot if the sun is shining on you. You're cold if you're in the shadow of the vehicle. And at the same time, you're in this vacuum bottle and you're generating body heat, and that's going to make you hot most of the time. So temperature is not this characteristic of the environment, right? Temperature is a characteristic of you or of your instrument. And really the characteristic of the environment is all the heat that's flowing in and out and radiating and convecting and conducting. That's what's characteristic of the environment. So when I say think like a Martian, and I wrote a little science fiction story about this a long time ago. When I say think like a Martian, what I mean is start off by imagining you lived on Mars, and what would change and what would be different, you know, about your experience of the world, and then ask how you apply that to the instruments or the systems or the processes you're building. And you'll encounter some surprises if you do that.
That example you gave is exactly the one I was hoping that you would, Mike. Here's to a great successful landing on Mars in February. Sounds like we very much might have more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to the show.
Matt, I would really look forward to it. And I just want to say also, the U.S. government, other governments, don't give us all this money. Don't give us, in the case of Mars 2020, $1.5 billion or $1 billion just to do something that will impress our fellow geologists and planetary scientists at professional meetings. They do that because the entire world looks to what we do for inspiration, for illumination, for a sense that we are extending the human experience where it's never gone before. And it's folks like you and shows like this that actually fulfill that mission. We're just the guys who do the work. You're the guys who actually deliver the work to the people at, you know, who are paying for it and who are receiving it and who are gaining from it. So thank you for that. Thank you and all your colleagues for doing what you do.
You are very welcome, Mike. Thank you for those kind comments. And that's why we do the show, because certainly why I do it, because it is a thrill to be able to talk to folks like you, leading teams that are doing this work that is expanding what we know of life, the universe, and everything. Mike, keep up the great work, and I look forward to talking again.
Thanks so much, Matt. So do I.
Mike Hecht of MIT is the MOXIE Principal Investigator and Deputy Project Director for the Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration. More is just ahead when we join Bruce Betts for What's Up. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, I'm Kate from the Planetary Society. For all its troubles, 2020 has still seen some terrific space accomplishments. We asked our members and supporters to vote for their 2020 favorites. You can see the results at planetary.org/best of 2020. We're talking about the best solar system image, the most exciting moment in planetary science, and much more. That's planetary.org/best of 2020. Happy holidays from the Planetary Society.
Hi, I'm Jason Davis, Editorial Director for the Planetary Society. Did you know there are more than 20 planetary science missions exploring our solar system? That means a lot of news happens in any given week. Here's how to keep up with it all. The Downlink is our new roundup of planetary exploration headlines. It connects you to the details when you want to dive deeper. From Mercury to interstellar space, we'll catch you up on what you might have missed. That's The Downlink, every Friday at planetary.org.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. So we are joined by Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who's here with me every week to talk about what's up in the night sky and much, much more. Fun contest answers this time around. Hi, welcome.
Hello. I'm excited, Matt.
Were you excited a couple of nights ago as we speak? Did you get to see the Geminids?
I got to see some clouds. They were lovely.
Me too.
I looked a little bit last night after the peak because it was clear. Didn't get to see that. How about you?
No, I only checked. We were up in the mountains. Nice dark sky. New moon, as you've told us there would be, because that you know. And now it was clouded over. It was overcast. So no luck. I don't know. I didn't get up again at 2 a.m. to check either. So all right. What else is up there that we may or may not be able to see?
Jupiter and Saturn. It's all about Jupiter and Saturn for the next couple weeks. You can ignore the rest of the sky. It's not important right now. Well, I mean, it's still fun. But Jupiter and Saturn will be closer on December 21st than they have been in almost 400 years as they appear in our sky. 6 or 7 arc minutes, so about a tenth of a degree apart. And that is the equivalent of being closer than a quarter of the moon's diameter. You should be able to resolve them still separated with decent eyesight. They'll be looking really cool. The challenge will be they're low, as you pointed out on a previous show, Matt, they're already low in the west, not long after sunset. So you'll want a pretty clear view to the west. And if you have clouds the night of the 21st, take heart. They're almost as close on the 20th and the 22nd. So look in the evening west. Jupiter, of course, is the really bright object, looking like a really bright star. Saturn looking like a yellower star. They should be in the same field of view for binoculars or most home telescopes, unless you get to a bigger telescope. So it's going to be groovy. Watch them get closer together coming up on the 21st and getting farther apart after that. We've got an article coming up on our website with more information at planetary.org. Did you have any further thoughts upon this, Matt?
Well, you did get this text message, came in moments ago from Mars, regarding comment, ignore rest of sky. What am I, chopped regolith?
Oh, okay. Several questions come to mind. strangely, the first to pop into my head was not why Mars was contacting us, but how it got around the light speed limit on communication. And I didn't know Mars could listen to the show early when we were recording.
Always.
I'm sorry, Mars.
We make it available.
Check out bright Mars, still bright in the south. When you're done looking at Jupiter and Saturn, or if you're an aerophile, just go ahead and check out Mars first and then Jupiter and Saturn. You know, Mars, you are far more than chopped regolith to me.
Wait, there's another text coming in. Oh, it's a red smiley face. I think we're good.
Oh, and before anyone gets angry, Venus, pre-dawn, east, sorry. And there are stars. There's so many stars. But Jupiter and Saturn doing something kind of special, that's all I'm saying. Mars is, of course, always special and near and dear to my heart.
I think we're good.
On to this week in space history. It was 1968 that Apollo 8 launched and sent the first humans around the moon.
Yeah.
We move on to random space fact.
A little trill. I like it.
Almost all Mars landers, and perhaps somewhat coincidentally, all successful Mars landers have been targeted to land northwards of about 15 degrees south on Mars. That's because Mars has this general topographic dichotomy with highlands in the south and lowlands in the north, at least on average. With Mars's atmosphere already really thin, landers need to get all the atmosphere they can get to slow down, and hence the targeting of lower elevations. We move on to the trivia contest, and I asked you how many aluminum panels are or were in the Arecibo radio dish. How'd we do?
A great response to this. I don't know if it's because everybody wants to proudly wear that new Planetary Society cap, which we will once again be giving away this week, or if it was in honor of Arecibo. Here is the answer hidden away In this week's submission from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild, down in a sinkhole they built Arecibo at 305 meters wide, inverted dome in its green island home with thousands of panels inside, made of aluminum, I'd say by rule of thumb, 7 by 3 feet across. 38 7 and 7 8 rectangles make this great telescope boss. Easier to understand? How about from Matt Cotter in Missouri? 38,778 panels and one Bond villain. They got the number right?
They did. They did indeed. That's a lot of panels.
Here's our winner. Sorry to keep stringing you along. Corey Schmidt, first-time winner in Missouri. They are... And then in parentheses were, 38,778 panels. They replaced the original wire mesh that was installed in 1963 when the dish opened. And then he added this. I luckily got a chance to visit the observatory a few years back while living in Puerto Rico and still have fond memories of my visit. I bought a commemorative pint glass as a souvenir, and from now on, every beer I drink from it will be bittersweet. Corey, congratulations. Nice message, and we hope this sweetens the memory a little bit. Maya Sukup in Newfoundland, Canada, as a geoscientist learning from your podcast that the dish was built into an extended limestone valley, that's something that Bill Nye mentioned, and that the contents were then used to construct support materials was very interesting. I wonder if they'll need geologists to find the next site. Are you volunteering, Maya? Just a couple more here. Fingers crossed, says Darren Ritchie, for a good Starship test today. He wrote this a few days ago. With that kind of payload capacity, perhaps an Arecibo 2 on the lunar far side would become feasible, would be a worthy successor. Finally, this from Gene Lewin in Washington. A loss to all, though not all know the impact of this tragic blow. A limestone cradle, a karst, was home to this Gregorian inverted dome. This void created by nature's wrath impedes our travel, but not our path. Rebuild this wonder. Return our sight. Reveal the mysteries of distant light. I'm going to send that one to Francisco Cordova, I think, the director of Arecibo.
Yeah, that's nice.
That's it. A lot of stuff there, so I guess we better move on.
Returning to Martian topography, in what feature is the lowest point on Mars? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Oh, wait, I got another text here. It's Mars again. All is forgiven.
Aww.
You have this time until Wednesday. That'd be Wednesday, December 23rd at 8 a.m. Pacific time. Your prize, should you get it right and be chosen, is going to be that Planetary Society baseball cap, which is now being featured at chopshopstore.com, or just go to planetary.org/store, and you can check out all our other merch as well. I think we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and thinking about using light waves to look at ocean waves, making sound waves that you hear. Thank you and good night.
Okay, I got to ask, is this happening?
Only in my mind.
It sounds brilliant, though. Maybe some New Earth observing satellite from NASA. All right, well, they owe you if they turn this into music. That's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its oxygen-loving members. Mark Hilvert is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.